It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, federal agencies have approved new banking rules aimed at getting some of the risk out of the industry. We'll hear what happened and what's going to change after 5:30.
First, a lot of Americans are scrambling to manage work lives and caring for older relatives, and it's often an overwhelming experience. According to an AARP survey, about half of employees in the United States expect to provide care for an older relative in the next 5 years. 4 in 10 of us will have already provided that kind of care.
Our next guest has advice on how to manage this juggling act, and you can join in with your questions and experiences. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amy Goyer is with us. She's aging, home, and family expert for AARP. She's the author of Juggling Work and Caregiving. That's a new free ebook from AARP. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. So nice to be with you.
So who is this affecting, and how many of us is this affecting?
You know, there are about 42 million caregivers in the United States, and about 74% of them have worked at some point during their caregiving journey, whether at a part-time job or a full-time job. So this affects a huge amount of the workforce. As you say, about half of the workforce is expected to be providing care for elders sometime during the next 5 years.
And one of the people this affecting is you. You've been through this multiple times, right?
I actually have. I cared for my grandparents when I was in my 20s and working full-time. And I have been caregiving for my parents in a very intense way for the past 5 years, and actually relocated across the country to be near with them and care for them. My mom just recently passed about 8 weeks ago, and my dad still lives with me, and he has Alzheimer's disease.
So you're managing a lot now, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much.
So there's a wide variety, a wide range of things. Talk about what makes a person a caregiver from just doing a little to doing a whole lot.
You know, there's really so many roles in being a caregiver. It may start out with some of the things that I did. You may just help a little bit here and there around the house, or with managing, you know, a complicated health situation, or help out with, you know, something that might be more difficult to manage in terms of the home or finances. And you might just be every now and then, but then you start to do it on a more regular basis as people need more assistance. And the range goes all the way up to someone like myself who has their parents living with them, who, you know, my parents essentially could not be alone, and my dad still can't. So you're essentially caring for all of their needs, physical, financial, health, food, everything.
We're going to spend most of our time on the practical advice and emotional advice you give in your book. But one thing I wanted to get to, I imagine everybody in this situation, it's unique and they feel overwhelmed. It seems like an overarching message you're sending is you're not alone.
That is exactly the message. I know, again, from my own experience, and I speak with caregivers all over the country about this, and everyone feels like they're the only ones doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, we all feel very isolated. You know, you think when you're raising kids, you have sort of a built-in peer group. You meet other parents through the kids. That doesn't really happen when you're caregiving, especially for older or family members. And, you know, the majority of us are caring for our older parents. So you feel very isolated.
Well, let's start getting into some of what to do. One of the first things, like you talk about in the book, is as you start to realize you have these time commitments that you have to juggle with work, how do you talk to your employer about getting some kind of flexibility to deal with these things?
Many people are intimidated about bringing this up at work because they're concerned about looking like they're not committed to their job or that they may not be a good employee. We generally say, in most cases, it's good to let your employer know what's going on in your life, because you don't want them to think that, you know, you're coming in late or calling in sick a lot or being away from work because you're not committed or you don't care about your job. You actually have a life experience going on that's very demanding. You want them to know and reassure them repeatedly that you're committed to your work, but it's helpful to talk it over with them. And if you're having some specific challenges, you can talk about some changes that could be made, what flexibility is there. And you might want to speak first with the Human Resources Department about what benefits are available for employees or what flexible work situations there are.
And you make the point that you don't have to necessarily put your career on hold or go in with the attitude that you're putting your career on hold while dealing with caregiving for an elderly relative.
You know, so many times it's just an overwhelming situation, and especially if there's a catastrophic health issue, someone has a heart attack or a stroke or something comes on suddenly, and you just feel like, I can't handle all this. I have to quit my job. That may not be the best choice for you for many reasons. One, you have to look at your own financial stability and your long-term financial security and planning for retirement. But you also have to realize that that's an important part of your identity. And it may be, I know for me, work is respite in a way. It's something I can throw myself into. Now, my work has to do with caregiving, but for all of us, there's a certain amount of us. So it might be better to make some slight changes in your work rather than quit altogether.
And one big point, and I think probably a lot of people have heard this, is you have to take care of yourself as well as the person you're giving care for. And everybody knows that, but how do we start making that a mindset and putting it into practice?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's probably the biggest challenge as a caregiver, is taking care of your own needs, because you have someone who you see is much more vulnerable than you are, and you're trying to care for them, and the needs can just be overwhelming at times. I think the important thing, and as you say, it's a mindset. You have to adjust your mindset to, literally, if I have to nurture myself and take in energy and have my energy levels up so that I can give to someone else. You know, the analogy that's often used is when you're on an airplane and they have the oxygen masks that drop down, and they say, always put it on the person, if there's a child or someone you're caring for, put it on yourself first, then put the oxygen mask on the other person. Because if you pass out before you get their mask on, nobody's taken care of. That's how it is with caregiving. So some of the practical things that I suggest are, work in the taking care of yourself with your caregiving. I know that for me, walking is my best exercise. And if I try to get out and do a lot on my own walking, I just never can find the time. But I can walk with my dad, and he likes to walk the dog. So I make sure that every day I get a walk in with my dad. Then I'm spending quality time with him, making sure he gets his exercise and I get mine. Another thing we did was, we have a pool because we live in Arizona and everyone has pools, and we did water exercises together. You know, you have to schedule in the care for yourself. I try to schedule in once a week something that's nurturing for me, whether it's a massage or spending time with friends or whatever it is that works for you. If you don't schedule that in your calendar and mark it down, the time will get eaten up by something else.
Part of that self-care is on the emotional side, things you might feel guilt, stress, fear, a lot of emotions can be involved in this caregiving and stressful situation. How do we cope emotionally?
Well, you really have to acknowledge those emotions and recognize them. And, you know, it's not a bad thing to feel resentful or angry or exhausted and fearful. Those things are part of the whole experience. So acknowledge those, but try to also look at the positives. What do you enjoy about caregiving? What makes you feel fulfilled, or that you feel good that you have this relationship with your loved one? Balance those emotions that way as much as you can, so that you can see it is a fully rounded experience. Sometimes it's very helpful to get support from other caregivers. Caregiver support groups can be a wonderful place to sort of vent those emotions, because other people are going through the same things.
But do people have time for that, to add a support group meeting to all the other responsibilities?
It's a real challenge. Many people tell me that that's their first priority of anything they do all week is going to their support group. But I do online support groups. It's very hard for me to get to an in-person group, but there are all kinds of online groups. AARP has an online community group for caregivers where you can post questions or just post a comment, oh, I'm having a really rough day, those sorts of things. Look for online, because you can do that at any time of day, even once your loved one's sleeping at night, or, you know, you can work that in sometimes better. And sometimes professional counseling is a real help as well.
We're talking to Amy Goyer about her new book for AARP. It's called Juggling Work and Caregiving.
And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Are you in this position, trying to juggle your work life while caring for an older relative? Let us know your thoughts and questions. Maybe you're looking for some advice. Our number once again, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org. We pick up our conversation now with Amy Goyer, author of Juggling Work and Caregiving.
And you can join the show. Are you trying to manage your work life and caring for an older relative, a parent maybe? Call and tell us your story. Call with your questions. Our guest has a lot of advice, or maybe you've got some advice of your own that you can share. Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to the phones now. We've got Jugbish calling from Germantown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for calling, taking my call. My mom is living with me since last 5 years. And sometime, as the author mentioned, we get angry because of some work related stress and some other stuff, and after that anger is over. I feel bad because I got angry on my mom, and that's so how do I how do I avoid those type of situation?
So anger and then guilt about the anger, Amy.
Boy, I know how you feel. You know, guilt seems to be our constant companion as caregivers. The key thing is that you need to recognize when your stress is building up. Stress and burnout, which is extreme stress when it's affecting every aspect of your life, it's so easy to reach that point. And then that's a lot of times when the anger comes in and boils over. So taking those steps ahead of time to recognize when you're starting to feel a little more irritated more frequently, when there's a situation that feels out of control or that you just can't figure out, that's the time to get help before you kind of reach that point of boiling over. When you do reach that anger point, take that as a signal. That's a time, again, if you've already reached that point, what can you change in the situation to kind of alleviate the pressure that's causing you to get angry? Maybe you need some more help caring for your mom. Maybe other families can help. Maybe a little bit of paid help now and then would be, you know, manageable, but give you just enough of a break to ease your stress.
Let's talk some more about that idea of getting help. I think a lot of people maybe feel like it's all on them. Where do we go to start building a team to help with the care?
Yeah, you know, your caregiving team, sometimes people don't have a lot of family members to help out, and so they feel like, well, I just don't have a team. Not true. Everyone that interacts with your loved one is part of your team, whether it be the doctors, nurses, home care providers, neighbors, your faith community, your loved one's friends, your friends. Everybody is part of your team. So taking an assessment of who could help out in different ways. I'll tell you, one of the most important members of my caregiving team is a woman who has a concierge business. She's sort of like a personal assistant. I found that I needed to be freed up so that I could do with the things for my parents that only I can do and to have quality time with them. So she helps me with things like running errands, sorting mail, helping me figure out complicated paperwork with insurance and things like that. Sometimes, you know, she'll come over and help me reorganize a closet, the things that build up and really cause you a lot of stress, but you can't just get done by yourself. So look at your caregiving team broadly. Go to the Area Agency on Aging in your local area. They're the top resource for knowing what's locally available. And then check out the AARP Online Caregiving Resource Center, and that's at aarp.org/caregiving. We have all kinds of resources, ideas there. Again, our online community can be very helpful.
And when somebody says, let me know if there's anything I can do to help, don't take that as just sort of a formal statement. You can really take them up on that.
Exactly. Accept help. It's really hard to do because, you know, sometimes we think we're the only ones who can do it right, and we care so much about our loved ones, we want it done correctly. But also, it's just sometimes hard to ask for help. So, A, ask for help, but B, many people offer, and they don't know what to do to help you. So it helps sometimes just to sit down and take 15 minutes and make a list of the kinds of things other people can do. Again, you may not want to ask someone to come and help your mother with personal care, but they might not mind at all watering your plants or sorting your mail or doing some things that would free your time up.
Go back to our callers now. We have Bill with us in Wakeville. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just want to say that it is really self-rewarding to actually take care of a family member in many situations. And one is that you become very close, not only as a relative, but as a friend. And it's kind of, you have to learn a balance and time out, and you find out kind of and design your own strong support system.
Great. Thanks for the call, Bill. And that's a good point, Amy. You're kind of touching on recognizing the whole emotional range of experience. And it isn't just anger, guilt, and stress. You're doing this out of love, and it can be a positive thing, too.
That is so true. A recent AARP poll found 8 in 10 people feel good about helping someone, 8 in 10 caregivers. 52% say, I'm really proud of what I'm doing. And 1 in 5 say they have a better relationship with that loved one. And I agree with the caller so much. You know, I have developed a different kind of relationship. I've always been close with my parents, but to be able to care for them is something that is so fulfilling, and I have a closer relationship with them as a friend, as you say, and almost as a peer, as a caregiver. It's just an incredibly rewarding relationship.
Switching gears again a little bit to a practical tip, you have a lot of advice on getting organized. Why is that so important, and how can we get started organizing ourselves for caregiving?
Well, when we're caregiving and working, time is at a premium. There aren't enough hours in the day to do everything. There just is so much. So you have to be organized. I really think it's the only way to survive the experience, because otherwise you're just constantly having a lot of things swimming around in your head that you haven't gotten done, and you just constantly feel like a failure. You've got to feel positive about some things, and getting organized can help. I have a lot in the book about how you can use technology to help yourself keep your loved one's information organized, their health records, their finances, but also using online tools or apps on your phone that help you, you know, with your grocery list and keeping track of legal documents, all kinds of things. And that has helped me a great deal, I know.
How do you know when it's time to go from maybe just every day helping out a little bit here and there to getting into helping navigate healthcare or helping manage finances? That's a big leap.
It is. But as I said, most people, this happens gradually, unless there's just suddenly a catastrophic health situation like a stroke, a heart attack, something happens. Even with those who have dementia, it's a process over time. And so you may start by helping out a little bit with those things, and then there comes a point where you realize this is too much for my loved one to deal with. If you've been helping a little bit gradually before it reaches that point, it's a lot easier for them to let go and allow you to manage something that they really can't handle anymore. Otherwise, you may have a little bit more of a struggle on your hands. I know with my dad, I saw the stress that was building up with him, and I had started out by, for example, with his finances. I got him a separate bank account with a separate ATM card where he just managed sort of his everyday things, and then I paid all his bills from another account. And eventually that was really getting to be a lot for him. So, you know, we made changes there. You know, you have to have conversations about these things ahead of time if you can. And those are difficult conversations. I have a lot of tips on the AARP website about how to have those conversations. And, you know, when do I need to do that? And the signs to look for. For example, if you see the mail building up when you go to visit for the holidays and you think, this is not right, Mom wouldn't usually let the mail pile up like that. I wonder if there are bills that are not getting paid. That's a red flag. Maybe they need a little bit help. Doesn't mean necessarily they need you to take everything over at that moment. Maybe they just need help sorting and organizing all of it.
In our last minute or so, you've mentioned a couple of resources throughout our conversation here. Are there a couple other places you might point people toward if they're in this situation where they can get help, advice, or a sympathetic ear?
Right. You know, as I mentioned, the AARP Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. We have resources there that will help get you back down to your local level as well. Your area agency on aging, you can look that up at eldercare.gov, and they can help you find local resources. And, you know, you need to reach out again. Look in your faith communities locally. Do they have some respite programs? Is there volunteers that might help out? Find out, you know, how you can help build your team, get support for yourself, and make sure your loved one is cared for.
Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and happy holidays to all of you.
To you too as well. That was Amy Goyer. She's aging, home, and family expert for AARP. She's the author of Juggling Work and Caregiving. It's a new free ebook, and we've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at the in-demand tech gifts this holiday season, from tablets to fitness bands and everything in between.
First, financial regulators approved a long-delayed measure earlier today that would impose tougher restrictions on banks and financial institutions.
The Volcker Rule, named after the former Federal Reserve Chairman, is a key part of 2010's Dodd-Frank Act, but just came up for a vote today among regulators after years of lobbying on both sides. Supporters say the rule would prevent future taxpayer-funded bailouts. Our next guest says the law is a lesson in how complicated simplifying Wall Street can be.
Joining us now to explain what the rule is and how it would work is Yalman Anaron, senior writer at Bloomberg News.
Yalman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Paul Volcker's name has become attached to this rule. What was he originally proposing and what was he hoping to accomplish?
Well, it's been many years, 4 years actually, when he first came up with this idea in 2009. Obama wasn't even sworn in yet. He was about to be as president. And Volcker was suggesting that risky trading by the largest banks is not allowed to be part of their institutions. That way, the riskiest stuff would be separated and done by hedge funds or other, you know, institutions that whose blow up and meltdown would not be necessarily the concern of taxpayers and governments. And that's how the idea started 4 years ago.
And this is in the aftermath of the economic meltdown in 2008. And I guess the idea is, these normal banks that are supposed to be doing boring stuff, a lot of people think, got themselves too leveraged on these exotic investments. Is that right?
Yes. Of course, you know, after the Great Depression, we passed Glass-Steagall, Congress passed Glass-Steagall to separate investment banking and all types of trading activities from the boring commercial banking, which is you take deposits and you lend it out to companies and consumers. And that was the rule for six decades at least. And then sort of in the 90s, it was softened and Citigroup was buying all these other companies and banks, and then finally in 99 Congress repealed Glass-Steagall and allowed the financial conglomerates to do whatever they felt like doing, and part of the problems with the crisis when we saw all the biggest banks being in trouble and some of them had to be rescued by the government was that they had done a lot of risky trading with derivatives and all these very wonderful sophisticated securities, you know, collateralized debt obligations and things like that, whose names we had never heard before until the crisis, and where everybody, they became household names.
So it seems pretty simple to just say there'll be some banks that handle the normal individual and commercial type things, and there'll be separate investment banks that'll do that more complicated high-risk stuff. But it's taken a few years to get to the point where we are today in setting the rules. Why is it so much more complicated than it might look at first blush?
Because this is not as straightforward separating everything Glass-Steagall, the way Glass-Steagall did after the Great Depression. Now, Volcker himself said, well, times are different, everything is more up-to-date, modern, and we can't tell the banks they cannot really do any investment banking. the brokerage and helping their clients do trades is part of their business, they can continue doing that. They just shouldn't be part of the betting that goes on, you know, whether interest rates will go up or down or whether, you know, markets are going to go up or down. They should really not do that part. So this is not as straightforward, not as clean cut, and so trying to get to that has been tough.
That sounds like it's going to be kind of difficult to untangle and enforce, right? We're saying banks, yes, you can do these kind of investments for your clients and to hedge against certain kinds of risks, but you can't do the other kind. Is there a real strong gray area in there that's going to be hard to enforce?
The enforcement is going to be pretty, it's going to be a nightmare, yes, because if the rules have certain definitions and restrictions and what's allowed and what's not allowed, but at the end, it really is up to the supervisors, to the banking regulators and the market regulators. There are five agencies involved in all this to make sure that it really, the institutions are following the spirit of the rule, and that's not going to be easy, and I'm sure it's going to require lots of people, and banks have to hire lots of extra compliance officers and make sure they're doing things the right way. So it's going to be interesting going forward.
The reaction I've seen from some of the big Wall Street-type banks is, you know what, we're already pretty close to being in compliance here. We've gotten out of that line of trade. Is that true?
Well, all the big banks shut down what they all called prop trading desks, and that was very narrow, very specific, focused on let's bet how things are going to happen, and they were separated from the rest of the trading operation, but they were small. I mean, a lot of them, they were 1-2% of their total trading operations. The biggest place where prop trading really happens and where these kind of risks might still be taking place is where they are supposed to be helping their clients, which is market making, it's called, and that's when they buy or sell all kinds of different assets and securities with the aim, supposedly, of helping their customers, which are hedge funds and institutional funds and asset management firms. But while they're doing that, they could still be taking risk by holding those things too long or buying more than they really need to buy for their clients. So the Volcker rule is supposed to ratchet that down and say, no, you need to really focus on the client and not try to make money, quick money, on the side of that, because that can end up piling up lots of risk and in the aggregate, and then we end up bailing you out.
So in effect, sort of, if Robco, my new business that doesn't exist, went into the bank and said, here's some of my money, you can invest it in these things and that's fine, that would still be allowed. But the bank can't then say, yeah, and we're going to set up some quick side hedge funds to make an extra 1.3% out of Rob's money while he's waiting for his return. That last part might be out of the picture then.
Yes, that's part of the rule, that banks actually cannot run their own hedge funds and their investment funds. They can invest very small portions in the hedge funds that they might have helped set up for clients. And also when they're helping their clients trade, let's say the client says, I want to sell, you know, 100 shares of IBM. And the bank says, okay, I'll take that, but I don't have anyone else who's willing to buy 100 shares. So they hold on to those 100 shares for a while, but the goal needs to be, according to the rule now, that you get rid of those 100 shares as soon as you can. You don't wait saying, maybe IBM is going to get really valuable in the next year, and so let's wait and make money on that. You know, it's like you're helping your client by taking the shares because nobody else wants it at that moment. But the first chance you get, you're supposed to get rid of it.
Most of us experience banks by depositing our paychecks, maybe getting a mortgage or car loan from our banks. How much are these new rules going to affect most of us who aren't dealing with these big number, more risky investments?
It should not affect us in that way. But, of course, the biggest problem, again, is the banks where we return to for our mortgages and for putting our money and being safe, et cetera. We trust that they're always there when we want to take our money out. last crisis, we saw that without government stepping in and putting hundreds of billions of dollars of capital and trillions of dollars of emergency cash from the Federal Reserve, they could not survive, and our money might not have been there when we wanted to take it out. So we rely on these banks, and we trust that they're always going to be fine. So the government now wants to make sure that while they're making that system safe, they don't have to dabble in these big risky, you know, every 3 seconds revolving trades and end up securing those and backing those as well.
So I won't see a day-to-day difference, but maybe my bank is a little less risky then.
That's the idea.
So you mentioned Glass-Steagall as a more simple alternative. Are people still pushing for that, for having an even firmer line than the Volcker rule between deposit-type banks and investment banks?
Some people still do. The FDIC vice chairman, Tom Honig, for example, has argued that that's really what we need to do, still go back to Glass-Steagall and separate investment banking from plain vanilla banking. There have been every congressional session, basically, there's been one proposal, bipartisan, from Republican and Democrat backings, but small groups of people saying, let's go back to Glass-Steagall. It hasn't gone anywhere. There was one time it faced a vote, maybe 2009 or 10, and it didn't pass, and it didn't garner enough support even in the Senate, and didn't even come up in the House. So that idea hasn't died, but it clearly doesn't have enough political backing out there to really become reality. So this is why it's sort of the second best.
Yeoman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeoman Anaran is a senior writer at Bloomberg News.
The holiday shopping season is in full swing. Chances are that at least one person on your list is going to want something in the high-tech gadget category.
But as always, there's a ton of choices out there, and it can be tough to know what's going to be a hit under the tree and what's going to be a flop.
Here to point us in the direction of some cool technology gifts is Omar Gayaga. He's technology culture reporter at the Austin American Statesman. Omar, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with tablets, if you will. They've been a popular gift the last few years, as I understand it. Is the iPad still the big name, or are there other tablets on the market that might trump them in gift buying this year?
Yeah, tablets are still very hot. PCs, you know, traditional PCs, laptops, and desktops are slowing down, and tablets are continuing to grow. Microsoft has made a really big push this year with its Surface 2 tablets. But iPad really is the one that I continue to recommend. The iPad Air, which is lighter and thinner than last year's model at about the same price, it continues to dominate. There are some great tablets on the Android side, but really the iPad continues to dominate on the tablet side at least.
What about tablets for kids?
There's actually one that I've been recommending called the Nobby Junior, Nick Junior Edition, which is a very kid-friendly tablet. It's kind of rubberized, so it doesn't fall and break like my iPad with my kids. It costs $140. Yeah, they break very easily in the hands of four-year-olds. For $140, it's branded with Dora the Explorer and a lot of the Nick Junior characters. It's internet safe. It blocks off internet content and has apps that are meant for that age group, you know, between 3 and about 7 to 8 years old. So that's a good one for that age group.
Before we move on from the tablets, just wanted to get your take on why the iPad. There's a lot on the market. Why is that still the top choice and why you're recommending it?
Well, really because it got there first. I mean, it got the advantage of being the first really good, solid tablet at around that price range, and there have just been so many good apps developed for it that Microsoft and on the Android side, there really aren't as many good tablet apps for the competitors than there are for the iPad. And every year, Apple continues to come out with, you know, faster versions of it, thinner versions of it, lighter versions of it, and keeping it at the same price. And now there's the iPad Mini, which, you know, for I believe it's $299, you know, you get the same Retina display, the same amount of apps, but in a smaller, lighter form. So, I mean, really, Apple is kind of running the table on tablets, and, you know, Microsoft's products on the Surface side just really haven't kept up. So I think, you know, there's definitely more competition this year than there was last year, but the iPad continues to be the one that dominates, that you just see everywhere and that people continue to buy.
And then any favorites in the Android world if people, for whatever reason, aren't sold on the iPad?
Yeah, the Samsung Galaxy Tab is a really good one. I believe it's a little bit less expensive than the iPad. And all of the Amazon Kindle tablets are very, very competitively priced. I mean, you can get an Amazon Kindle Fire for about half the price of an iPad Air. And, you know, it's not going to run as many apps. It's going to be more for consumption of media than creating media. But for most people that just want to watch movies or read books, you know, that's at $199, that's, you know, the perfect gift. So iPads are very versatile. They do a lot of things. If you want something that's a little bit more limited and much cheaper, you probably want to go with something like an Amazon Kindle Fire.
Well, let's move on to video game consoles. They're expected to be a big seller this year. And the PlayStation 4, the Xbox One, they both hit the market in the last month. What can you tell us about those systems?
Yeah, this is a very unusual year. Last year we had the Nintendo Wii U debuted, and this year we have two big console launches, both within a week of each other, which is very, very unusual. These, the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3, the predecessors, you know, were 7, 8 years old. So this is the first, you know, next generation set of consoles that we've had in a really long time. They're pricey. The Xbox One is $500. The PlayStation 4 is $400. And that's with one controller, no games. You know, you're going to be paying tax, you're going to be paying for an extra controller, you're going to be paying for accessories probably, and the games are $50, $60. So these are not for casual gamers. These are pretty much for the frontline hardcore gamers that want to be the first to play Call of Duty on these next generation consoles and play a lot online. So I would recommend these for really hardcore early adopter gamers. For more casual gamers, I would kind of stick with you know, the older consoles or the Wii U, which actually the best game I've played all holiday season isn't on either of those. It's Super Mario 3D World for the Wii U, and that's not even on either of those new consoles. So there's a lot of hype and a lot of excitement around the Xbox One and the PS4, but it's very early. There are very few games, and they're still very expensive, so you got to think about that.
Do you have a sense if somebody's really insisting on getting one of the two new ones, if one is, say, more kid-friendly than the other?
Well, if you're going for kid-friendly, I would go Nintendo, honestly. But of the two, I mean, they both have you know, parental blocks and things like that. The Xbox One is making some people leery because it comes with a camera. It comes with a Kinect kind of always-on camera that's always watching you. And that might make it easier for kids to control. You know, they can use voice commands that the camera will recognize them as they walk into the room. But some parents might find that a little creepy. They
yeah.
might worry that their kids, you know, it's going to be recording their kids and putting stuff online. Microsoft has fought really hard to kind of combat that perception. But, you know, you are going to have an always-on camera in your house, you know, facing you in the living room all the time. And some parents might worry about that. The PlayStation 4 is, from my view, seems more geared toward older gamers. There's not a lot of kid-friendly games on it so far. There's great action games, great shooter games, but I haven't seen a lot of kid-friendly games on the PlayStation 4 yet.
I'm a big fan of going with the last generation stuff. You know, the games are out there. You can see reviews of them. You can usually find them used. Is there a danger, though, of those being obsolete and running out of things to do with them?
Not really. And, you know, the biggest game of the entire year was Grand Theft Auto 5, and that's not on either of the new consoles. That's, you know, you have to have a PlayStation 3 or an Xbox 360 to play that. So, you know, people are still playing that game. There's still great new games coming out for both of those consoles. I think it's going to be about a good year or so at least before you start to see stuff peter out on the older consoles because they have huge installed bases. If you're a video game maker, you're going to want to make a game for the biggest audience possible. And right now, that's not the Xbox One or the PS4 or even the Wii U. That's the older Xbox 360 and PS3. That's what most people have in their house right now.
Well, moving on to smartphones, we see two top competitors are the iPhone and the Android phones. Would you recommend that people currently with an iPhone, is it worth it to upgrade to the iPhone 5S?
I think if you have anything older than an iPhone 4S, if you have an iPhone 4 or anything older than that, I think it's definitely worth the upgrade. The camera is much better. It's a speedier phone. It runs on an LTE networks, which are much faster than the old 4G ones. It's definitely a good upgrade, and there's a lot of holiday deals right now. You can get an iPhone for under $99, an iPhone 5S or a 5C, you know, really cheap right now, especially if you trade in your old device. If you already have an iPhone 5, I would probably hold off until next year. I would wait a little bit. It's not that big of a step up from the 5 to the 5S. There's the fingerprint scanner on it, which is kind of neat, but you probably won't use it all the time. The camera's better, but you know, you really got to think about the 2-year contract if you're under that, and I would hold off if you have a 5.
We heard from a listener named Jen. She's wondering, her parents are 91 and 92 years old. They just email and they do Google searches. Should she get them a desktop computer or something else that's higher tech but easy to use?
That's a good question. I mean, a lot of it would have to do with what they already have and what they're used to. I mean, you don't want to introduce something that's going to completely throw them for a loop and that they're not going to be able to get used to right away. You know, you want to get something that they'll be up and running. If they already are used to a desktop PC, you might want to think about a laptop that's maybe a little bit lighter but runs the same kind of software, or a tablet even. I mean, if they're Windows users, a Microsoft Windows tablet might be good that can run the older software but also run, you know, kind of touch-friendly tablet stuff. I found people, above 60 really tend to like the Amazon Kindle devices and also really gravitate toward the iPad. You know, the iPad would be a completely different experience, but it's intuitive enough that I think they would probably get it right away.
Omar, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy holidays.
You too. That's Omar Gayaga. He's technology culture reporter at the Austin American-Statesman.